This is Liz Scafidi with UN News. Questioning the details and attempting to distort actual history, its chronology or statistics, are just a few examples of Holocaust or genocide denial. Often, that leaves a window open, creates oxygen in the room for extremism, and it is a signal of prejudiced, racist, and anti-Semitic beliefs. That's the view of Sarah Brown, Executive Director of Change, the Center for Holocaust, Human Rights, and Genocide Education in New Jersey, United States. At a time when anti-Semitism is growing as a global issue and the United Nations is implementing the recently launched UN system-wide strategy to combat hate speech, Ms. Brown came to UN headquarters in New York to participate in a panel discussion about these crucial issues. She spoke to Anna Carmo of UN News about the importance of education and countering the hate narratives.
The tricky thing about much of what constitutes Holocaust denial and distortion is that so much of it is indirect and it's not explicit. It can be guised under the guise of in the interest of journalistic inquiry or intellectual inquiry, just questioning some of the details or saying something to the effect of 6 million, it just seems like such a tremendous number. I'm not so sure that is that number, possibly it's inflated. So just inferring that there could be exaggeration, there could be manipulation of facts. Oftentimes the Holocaust denial that we deal with is that more difficult to identify under the surface, less explicit denial, and these attempts to distort the actual history of the Holocaust, chronology of events, statistics. It's a very insidious and nefarious and intangible thing to chase, because sometimes people will say to you, but in the spirit of intellectual inquiry, this is something that I should be able to question and think about. And shouldn't we think critically about the history of World War II and the Holocaust? To which you must say yes. However, attempts to distort, obfuscate the truth, hide facts, question the integrity of the history and also that of the survivors and the witnesses of the Holocaust, that is Holocaust denial and distortion, in my opinion.
And how does that increase hate speech in general?
I think oftentimes it leaves a window open and it creates oxygen in the room for extremism, for if a group is lying about their victimization during an instance in history, well, what is it about that group that leads them to lie, manipulate, change those facts? And it also is a signal, I think, to people with existing racist, prejudiced, anti-Semitic beliefs in the instance of the Holocaust, but this is not strictly something that happens with the Holocaust. We see this with the Armenian genocide. We see this with the genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda. We see it with the Cambodian genocide. Many of these large-scale instances of genocide, especially in the modern history, 20th, 21st century, denial is a stage in the process of genocide. It's been identified as, depending on who you subscribe to, the 8 stages or 10 stages of denial. And it often begins well before the genocide is underway, and it lasts long after the genocide is over. And it is a signal. It's a space where you're saying it's okay to also further victimize and attack the victim group.
There's still this idea that Holocaust denial and anti-Semitism is a problem of the Jews only. Mm-hmm. But it's really something that affects us all.
It's a human problem. It's a human issue. The story of the Holocaust is the story of human suffering and the breakdown of society. If we limit it to being a Jewish problem, we're forgetting, first of all, we do such a great disservice to the millions of others who were victimized, but also to all of the different actors and stakeholders around the globe who got involved. So it's not a it's not a Jewish issue. It is a human issue. And I'm reminded of something that Deborah Lipstadt said recently, where she said, no healthy democratic society can harbor anti-Semitism, that kind of animus, and call themselves a healthy democracy. It goes against our very democratic tenets. It goes against the very social contract that brings together humanity and makes us accountable to one another. And so, no, I argue that anti-Semitism is not a Jewish issue. It is, unfortunately, a growing global issue.
Why do you think it's increasing so fast in Europe, in the Middle East specifically? And how can we fight that back?
I appreciate you asking the small questions. These are that's a very big question. I think that we're going through a stage of uncertainty and growth. And that in those moments of uncertainty, sometimes it is easy to lean on simplified narratives, to find scapegoats, to cling to that which we think we know that is a safe space, like nationalism. And those types of divisive and exclusionary beliefs are limiting. It's wonderful to have pride for your country, to have pride for your faith group or your belief group, your political party. But when you do it at the expense of others and cast an in-group and out-group mentality towards others who do not share those same beliefs, it's extremely problematic. And I'm seeing a resurgence of that, I think, in response to certain uncertainties and such rapid development that's been happening around our globalized, now very globalized, hyper-globalized world. You're seeing it also with political instability and all kinds of changes happening. I say this today with Brexit happening as we speak, and other instances of social and political upheaval. I think that this is something that has to be actively and critically thought about and combated so that we don't fall on those old tropes that have often led us to not just national conflict, but global conflict.
Sometimes I wonder if there's anything that you feel like the ordinary person can do to help in this global issue.
We have that question brought to us often by our students who come into our programs, and they are sometimes overwhelmed by the enormity of it. One of the ways that we work around that and help them to drill down on single narratives is that we tell a lot of our local survivor narratives and testimonies. And when they're able to trace one person and the choices they made and how one person made a difference, sometimes they're able to identify themselves within that narrative and think about how that one person can make a difference. We recently had a survivor of the genocide against the Tutsi in Rwanda, a young man named Yannick Tona, speaking to our students and at one of our middle schools. And he kept emphasizing the fact that it comes down to choice and it comes down to what you choose to do in a given day. And it may not be that you wake up one day and you have to flee for your life like I did. This is speaking what Yannick was saying to them. He said maybe it's deciding to be a friend to someone who's in the cafeteria and is sitting all by themselves. Or maybe it's standing up when you see bullying or wrongdoing, or you hear someone make a racist or a prejudiced remark. Drilling it down to the individual ownership and then acknowledging that it's an unfortunate thing to consider, but with the Holocaust, 6 million people died. That's a huge number. We lose the people in that number. That's 6 million people, one by one by one by one, who were murdered by other individual people. So too can students, I think about how they, one by one by one, can affect change in a positive way and break that cycle, counter that a hate-based narrative, and instead create a more positive and inclusive and welcoming society.
Can you talk about what your organization does and how does it fight back?
Sure, happily. So CHANGE, with two H's, the Center for Holocaust, Human Rights, and Genocide Education, has been around since 1979. So we're in our 41st year. And our mandate is to fight this racism, prejudice, and anti-Semitism, and all forms of intolerance through education about the Holocaust, genocide, and human rights, and to use innovative educational programming and an inclusive methodology that brings in survivors from all genocides and instances of atrocities, a broad and diverse array of community stakeholders, students, educators, bring them in and give them the facts and the figures and the space where they can start examining the choices that individuals made during these instances of what is social upheaval, and examine both the cautionary tales, so the tales of perpetration and the unfortunate stories of many of the victims of these instances of genocide, but also the stories of rescue and resistance, those upstanders, to quote former UN ambassador to the United States, Samantha Power, the upstanders who actually made a choice, again, it all drills down to choice, made a choice to stand up and do something. And so we use our innovative educational approach to reach our community. And happily, our community is not limited by geographic boundaries. We think of community as expanding well beyond Lincroft, New Jersey, Monmouth County, New Jersey, the United States, and beyond. And we use that to collaborate and work with partners around the globe.
Can you speak a little bit about a program that I saw on your website called Building Bridges?
Happily, yes.
Something that works with the youth in particular?
Building Bridges is this very unique curriculum that was designed by my predecessor, Dale Daniels, who was the first executive director at Change, and her colleague and brain thought partner, Susan Yellen. And it basically harnesses a number of programs that already are in place, and we place them in a year-long curriculum for students across disciplines. So not limited to students that are in a history class, but also in ELA, in art, in all these other different math and sciences, actually. We've had some success with that. And we deliver a suite of programs to students over the course of a year, but also to their teachers. So we're doing professional development workshops for the educators themselves. We're doing programming for the students. We bring survivors in. We have them analyze diaries from youth, usually around their age, who survived or were victims of instances of atrocities. We have an art program that they participate in. All of these aspects, all of these pieces come together to help the students develop a tolerance is such a low bar to set. Like, if I tolerate you, really, what have we achieved? It's not just tolerance. It's about overcoming that, overcoming prejudice, overcoming racism and anti-Semitism, and embracing the other, celebrating the other, and also finding your voice, deciding what kind of choices you want to make in society, and enabling and empowering these students, especially at a crucial age in their growth where they're starting to exercise their own agency and understand their potential and their role in society.
Is there anything else that you would like to add? You're here at UN today to speak in this panel discussion.
You know, it's really funny. Yes, I'll tell you one small thing. This morning I pulled out my my husband's family. He's a third generation survivor, meaning that he had four grandparents who all survived the Holocaust. Two of them from Czechoslovakia and two from Greece. And it was funny. His family gave me the Jewish star that his grandmother, who survived Auschwitz, wore every day after she came to America. She survived and she came to America, and they gave it to me. And I've hesitated to wear it, but today was a day where I felt like it was appropriate to wear it, just out of gratitude for the fact that the United Nations now exists. And so here we are trying to affect difference and positive change.